the Buddha, which is Dharma, which is the Sangha. Today and tomorrow I'm going to talk on the master-disciple relationship. The timing of this is not accidental. It's a really important to talk about this right now. I don't pretend to know all the reasons. It's very important to talk about this right now. I gave people this wonderful article by Ramester on the meaning of discipleship, and this also wonderful excerpted article, really. I mean, it's an article made up of experts, excerpts, together, from Durkheim's book called The Call for the Master. And I'll use them and some other things the Rim Master said about the master-disciple relationship. To start with, I'm going to talk a little bit about the first paragraph of each of these articles. They start out in very different positions. They're both based on a sound understanding of the fundamental role that the master-disciple relationship plays in the transmission of the Buddha's teaching and the realization of the Buddha's truth in a person's individual private life. I say an individual private life because discipleship is not something that's a corporate endeavor, despite what some people try to make it in modern times and what some people probably have tried to make it throughout the centuries. It's individuals who undertake the true path that the Buddha himself undertook. And whether they seem at times to walk alone or with others, you're always alone in the essential thing. It's you and the eternal. And the master both pointing toward and representing the eternal for you. And right there is the explanation of why this is really important at the present time to talk about this. Let's see how her master starts her article. It's called The Meaning of Discipleship. She says, "A disciple is someone who truly believes in his master. But it's more than belief. I promised Koho Zenji I would stay with him until he was dead. I did just that. I promised him I would guard his foreign disciples. I have done that too, to the best of my ability. Discipleship entails obedience, however unusual may be the circumstances and requests of the master, because that which the master passes on to a disciple is so exquisite, so wonderful. I can't explain this. It is necessary to go into full-time training to do transmission and become one with the master as I became one with Koho Zenji in order to understand." Right off the bat, you notice the master is not talking about how to make this relationship safe. She's putting it right out there. And, you know, when Reverend Master went to Japan to undertake training with Koho Zenji, you know, she was asked at the gate of the temple, what is your purpose for being here. What is it you are seeking? And she simply said, the perfection of Zen. This article is written from the point of view of someone who went for the perfection of Zen and who realized what the perfection of Zen is in her own experience. The fact that this has some scary aspects simply is not the issue. The issue here is, what is it that you have to do to realize the perfection of Zen? When all conditions ripen, you're brought together with your master. You get nowhere if you don't trust your master completely. At other times, in another context, our master said some things about obedience. And I want to, she emphasizes obedience here, so I want to just mention what obedience means within this context, within the context of the master-disciple relationship, and within the context of Buddhism. The kind of faith that Reverend Master is talking about here is not what's called blind faith. The kind of obedience that Reverend Master is talking about here is not what you could call blind obedience. That which brings us into the master-disciple relationship is the eternal itself, our own Buddha nature. That which is the purpose of religion is the reharmonization with our own Buddha nature. The master represents the eternal, and the master is not the eternal. You can't take a spiritual shoehorn and cram the master into the place of the eternal in some absolute way. The master is a human being. Blind faith attempts to do that, and blind obedience attempts to do that, and that's not the point here. I'm going to give an example or two from my own experience that show the difference here in a minute. And there is obedience. But what does that mean? What is it that we are following? A true master is not interested, interestingly enough, in the disciple in some formulaic way of following him or her. The whole point of the master is to help the disciple follow the eternal. And if the master is truly following the eternal, then the following that happens is a following of oneness between master and disciple. If either one of them veers out of following the eternal in a truly willful way, then it's actually the duty of the other to stick with the following of the eternal and to help, if possible, the other person get back on track. And that's all true, and what Reverend Master says here is completely true. Don't create an opposition where there is not one. One has to have a kaleidoscopic mind. This is Buddhism. This is not something other than Buddhism. We would like it to be simpler and easier than it is. It's as difficult and as complex as it is. Sometimes it appears to be very simple, very direct. Sometimes it appears to be very complex, very indirect. The appearances, you can't go by appearances, you got to go by your heart. Always it is the master's duty to follow his or her heart. That's true obedience. Always it is the disciple's duty to follow his or her heart. That is true obedience. So I want to give a couple examples from my own experience my own experience and how to get it right. And I've given plenty of examples over the years of my own experience on how not to get it right, too. And I may do that. But for now, what comes up is to talk about how it can be done right. At a certain point, when I was training with her master at the Abbey, I was the person who wrote down the rules as she made them. And sometimes when my master would make a rule, it would come out, let's say, rather steamy. She always made rules in response to a need. And often the need was a rather messy crisis in the monastery. And she would sometimes, usually after the crisis, she'd have the rather human reaction. She'd say, well, we need a rule about that, and I want it like this. And come out pretty forcefully, let's say. What I did was, I'd take in what River Master said, and I would sit with it. I'd meditate with it. I'd give it a little time, and what I would do is, I would look for what was the true spirit of the teaching that she was giving in that rule. And when I felt that, when I knew in my blood and bones that it was cooked in me, I would regurgitate that rule to her in words different than it came out in, but that were entirely in accord with the spirit of what she was saying. Sometimes a letter would be pretty different, but the spirit never was. And I do not remember a single instance in which River Master did not say, yes, that's it, and was perfectly happy with it when I did that. And I always did that. Sometimes River Master would then say, well, and I want this in it. By that time, the situation was in the past. We'd all settled down. You know, we had the perspective. That's obedience. I was fulfilling the spirit of what Master was asking. I was not always doing the letter immediately, because I'm responsible to something greater than me and Reverend Master as human beings, as is she. And there was always complete accord and oneness in the result. That's, I think, a good example of being a discipleship who is completely obedient. A disciple who is completely obedient, as we understand it. Reverend Master used to say, you know, don't copy the Master's mistakes, for crying out loud. You know, always worried about, you know, my humanity hangs out there in the breeze, and it worries me sometimes when I see my disciples in some way, you know, copy my mistake. Don't, for crying out loud, do not, if I'm being an idiot, don't be an idiot yourself. How can that possibly help either of us? And if you're being an idiot, I'll try not to be like you at the time. And none of these aspects of our humanity stand against the need on your part, if you're my disciple, and on my part, if I am your master, for complete trust. I've often said, it doesn't even occur to people as disciples. I mean, it truly never occurred to me. Only in being a master myself have I even begun to realize the extent, and to me now it seems an amazing extent, to which River Master trusted me. And the risk she took in trusting me. I was always so concerned, you know, about my own side of trust. Now as a master, I realize how much you have to trust as a master. It's the same trust. How can you take trust and faith and cut them, carve them up and call one part disciple and one part master? If you can't trust as a disciple, you won't trust as a master truly. If you can't trust as a master, you weren't trusting as a disciple. and we encounter the same human difficulties, both in position as master and in position as disciple. This first sentence of this is so magnificent, and it is so pure and simple, and it is so true. A disciple is someone who truly believes in his master. And it really is, that's it right there. A disciple is someone who truly believes in his master. I've read this before in recent months. I'll read it again because it's still as fine an expression of what discipleship is. Because I know that the post word to How to Grow Lotus Blossom, trainees come and go. They train themselves or they do not according to their personal bent. If they are truly my disciples, they try to follow my teaching. This doesn't have to anything to do with whether the master is alive or dead, present or not present. If they're truly my disciple, they try to follow my teaching. If they are not, they go their own way. Either way, it is not my problem, nor is it the Lord's. Nor is it the problem of the eternal. Really, how can it be anyone's problem but mine as a disciple? How I conduct my discipleship and what it means to me and how seriously I take it. Certainly not Reverend Master's problem. Reverend Master's been dead for, 15 years now. But I'll tell you, if I am not fulfilling the pledge to myself that's inherent in my discipleship, it's a problem for me. It really is a problem for me. Just because my master is dead doesn't mean she's gone from my heart, or doesn't mean that she's not there in reality. Reality with a capital R. The same reality that I truly am in, and all of us. And to violate one's discipleship is to violate something in oneself. It's that simple. It is that simple. Here's another thing Reverend Master wrote that's from Zen's Eternal Life that fills out what she means. It follows logically from this that the pupil must have absolute faith in the Buddha nature of the teacher, not blind faith. She's careful in the words she uses. Not blind faith. Absolute faith. Later on, she uses the term perfect faith. A faith that comes from looking up, not looking down. The pupil must have absolute faith in the Buddha nature of the teacher. Otherwise, he will always be criticizing his actions in his own mind and not be able to breed the necessary trust, which is absolutely essential between master and disciple before transmission can occur. And even if I found out this the hard way, even if we have that trust at the time of transmission, you know, if we don't keep nurturing it and guarding it, you know, we can lose it. And we can lose it for a while, or start to lose it, and we can recover it. It's just whether we're looking up or down, really. And here, she didn't say this here, she didn't say this anywhere here, but this is where the principle I was clearly shown in a retreat in 1980, many years ago, really comes into play. All doubt is rooted in self-doubt. If you cannot really trust the Buddha nature of the teacher, it means you can't trust, you're not trusting your own. Looking back, I learned this as a disciple, and I see it as a master. Over the years of training disciples, I've seen it in disciples. The ones who could not in the end trust were simply the ones who were judging themselves so severely. It was not like this was subtle, it was obvious to me and to others in the community. Later on, she says, without faith in the teacher, the pupil will get nowhere. When the average, here, listen to this. So prophetic, you know. When the average Western student, whereas the average Western student will accept two-facedness, or what appears to be two-facedness, the fact that you can never pin the master down. The master's always changing, and sometimes does somewhat shocking reversals of position on things. She says, whereas the average Western student will accept two-facedness from an Oriental, whitewashing the contradiction with the thought that it is inexplicable as part of the mysterious East, when faced with the same situation presented by a Western teacher, he has no way of rationalizing it, and so either ends up hating and distrusting the teacher or walking completely out of Zen. If he took the trouble to look a little harder, he would realize that the problem for an Oriental student with an Oriental teacher is exactly the same as his own one, with this difference. The Oriental student does not try to rationalize the behavior of his teachers. He simply accepts it, however irrational it may seem to us. The Western student, with his sharpened critical faculties, has great difficulty in trusting a teacher to this same extent, and so is hardly ever capable of surmounting the problem. But if the student from the West is seeking true religion and not Eastern mysticism and culture, he will trust his teacher completely, for the teacher is seeing beyond the opposites to the true heart of the matter. That others cannot see this heart as clearly as he can is a source of grief to him, and he wishes deeply that they may share with him the joy of knowledge and true freedom. This is so prophetic. I mean, it was what Rem Master saw in the Far East. And it was always her experience with her own disciples. The people who would not muster enough faith within themselves ended up hating, distrusting, and sometimes hating. And without complete trust in the teacher, one is not going to go anywhere in this business. This is not a popular teaching right now. It probably never was, actually. You know, we tend to have a pretty limited perspective on things. I don't think this was ever popular, you know, way of viewing things. Anywhere, probably. It might be a little easier in the Far East, or might have been at certain times. But when it gets right down to it, if you read the stories of the relationships between master and disciple, the old stories, you know, Zen stories, I don't see people having an easy time of it. The fact that it's not easy doesn't mean it's not possible. And there always is the possibility for someone who really, truly says, I want the perfection of Zen, and I'm willing to pay whatever the price is, no conditions. As Reverend Master said, no quarter given or received. I'm willing to pay whatever the price is. That the way is open to such a person. All I can say. There is no true obstacle for such a person. There will be many seeming obstacles. But nothing can stop you if you take that point of view and you keep it up. If we look now at the Durkheim article, here's how he begins it. He says, the word master means three things: the eternal master, the here and now master, the inner master. The eternal master is a principle, perceived in a primal image, an idea, an archetype. The here and now master is a living embodiment of that principle in a given time and place. The inner master is the possibility, individually sensed as promise, potential, and obligation, at giving the eternal master physical form and reality in one's own life. Now, this is a somewhat philosophically expressed, but it isn't just philosophy. This is very close. And I don't know if he was thinking of the Buddhist teaching of the Trikaya, or the three bodies of the Buddha, but let's just talk for a moment about the three bodies of the Buddha, because I think that whether he was thinking of it or not, it's what he really means. So, and this is just straight Mahayana Buddhism. Isn't that something I'm making up, or a master made up, or that was made up in the last century or two or five or ten? So, the three bodies of the Buddha. The Dharmakaya, what we call the Buddha nature, the eternal, the cosmic Buddha, the truth with a capital T, reality with a capital R. He calls it a number of things. He calls it otherworldly being with a capital B. Not the, you always have to worry about a little bit. This is translated from German to English. Otherworldly might not be quite the right word. It doesn't mean like alien from another planet. It means transcendent. Transcendent being. Transcending all external conditions. Be, with a capital B. You know, the true reality of all things. That which you know with your blood and bones and that you're never going to understand with your head. But when you truly know that you know it with your blood and bones, then you're content with it. Rimmer Master said again and again in 76 and 77, it is enough for me to know the Lord of the house. That Lord of the house that she's talking about, that's Dharmakaya. I don't know it with my head. I never have. I know it with my whole being. I know it. It is. I know it is. I know its isness. By the way, another term used is suchness or thusness. Tathata. That's also Buddha nature is talking about. Buddhism is full of terms for it. Some of them are kind of philosophical sounding. A lot of them translate in a way that's very misleading. But that's what he's talking about there. He says, the eternal master. What could be more clear? When he says, the eternal master is a principle perceived in a primal image, he should, if he's going to use the word principle there, he should have it capital P. The translator should do capital P there. It's not an idea. It's not an archetype like a Jungian archetype. It's not anything like that. The eternal is the true reality, the true nature of all things. And it is perceived in different ways. Or understood in different ways. And the fundamental understanding that all of those others derive from is that blood and bones understanding. This is why trying to describe this, if you've had Kensho, trying to describe what happens in Kensho to people who haven't had Kensho is impossible. But Kensho means awakening to your true nature. And it is the full body and mind, full being experience of the eternal. Of being taken back by the eternal completely. And of surrendering completely to the eternal. The here and now master is corresponds exactly to what is called the Nirmanakaya. Traditionally, when this doctrine was first elucidated, the Nirmanakaya was the historical Buddha. But of course, the Nirmanakaya is anyone in whom the Buddha nature shows clearly, who's manifest, whose life is in harmony with the eternal. That's Nirmanakaya. Dharmakaya means body of truth. Capital T. Nirmanakaya means body of appearance. And that's the perfect, you know, for me, who, you know, Ribbon Master Jiyu, my master is Nirmanakaya above all others. So much so that if I dream and she's there, you know, it's always it always has a special meaning for me, you know. Then there's the inner master. He says about the, I'm getting ahead of myself. The here and now master is the living embodiment of that principle, the living embodiment of the eternal in a given time and place. The master said, the master represents the eternal for the disciple. That says it right here. Shows the eternal, represents for the disciple. So the disciple can help the disciple muster faith in their own Buddha nature to see it in another. If you can see the Buddha nature in the master, you can find it in yourself. If you can't see it in the Buddha nature, in the master, you can't see it in yourself. Because there is, in reality, there is no self and other. But in the Dharmakaya, there is no self and other, the deepest level. He goes on to say the inner master, the third. Now, the inner master here, what I'm thinking is kind of corresponds to what's called Sambhogakaya, which is usually translated as something like the reward body. The reward body. How does this human being come to know oneness with, come to experience oneness with the Dharmakaya? Through the reward body, the merit of the training manifesting in our actual experience of Buddha nature. Knowing with our body and mind the welling up of the water of the Spirit, the welling up of the love for the eternal, the welling up for the longing for the eternal. These are all manifestations of merit. And remember, this is not merit that we create. This is merit that derives from the Dharmakaya. It's a merit we share in, not what we create. All merit, as Bodhidharma said, comes from the Dharmakaya. So he says, the inner master is the possibility, individually sensed as promise, potential, and obligation, of giving the eternal master physical form and reality in one's own life, Sambhogakaya. I don't know if he was thinking of these three, but this is just understood properly. This is just good old Mahayana Buddhism here. And it really explains why you can't dispense with the master-disciple relationship. So if everything in one is drawing one to one's master, then one's got to go. That's the offering from the eternal. Now I want to conclude this talk with what I will, I think, begin tomorrow's talk with. And I've been saying it for a long time, but it's just the kind of thing that it just has to be said again and again and again, especially right now, that there's nothing accidental about the master-disciple relationship. That when all conditions ripen, someone who has the potential for true disciple is offered, is brought together in some way with their master. And this is arranged not by either master or disciple, but by the eternal, in a way that you could not possibly have foreseen. That's why there's all these interesting stories about how people come to their teacher. Many of them, you know, very improbable seeming. But it's said in Zen, when the disciple is ready, the master appears. What is the agent that makes this happen? It is the eternal itself. Therefore, the master-disciple relationship is a gift to a heart that is yearning for oneness with the eternal. It is a gift to that heart. a gift to be treasured all our lives, a gift to be guarded and nurtured, and not a gift to be subjected to worldly values and worldly beliefs and worldly skepticism. Like I say, but we'll start somewhere around that position tomorrow morning. Should the Buddha, should Dharma, should the Sangha.